Welcome to EIR Talks. On May 4th through 6th, over 400 representatives from 40 nations on six continents, including numerous active and former diplomats, came together in Bad Schwalbach, Germany for the International Conference of the Schiller Institute under the banner, The Ecumenical Battle for the Common Good. This week, we feature excerpts from the discussion period which followed the keynote presentations by EIR's founding editor, Lyndon LaRouche, who's running for president of the United States in the year 2004, and also Russian economists Dr. Sergei Glazyev and Professor Stanislav Menshikov. We'll begin with a comment from the nation of Georgia.
First of all, thank you very much for your attention to me. First of all, I want to say that thank you all that invited in conference small delegation from small Georgia. I wanted to say that I want to represent my colleague from Georgia. I explain why it is important for this moment. You know that situation in Georgia is very, very difficult. In this time, the one high school called Diplomatic Academy of Georgia studying ideas of Mr. LaRouche and his colleagues by articles of EIR, New Federalist, Fidelio, and others. They make seminar. 100 and 100 students, day by day and year by year, are studying their future in diplomatic practice, that they must be a diplomat with pure head. It is not so easy. You must know you are from great countries, from United States, from Russia, independent from China. So for you, it is impossible to think how it is difficult for my small and poor country. When we had in a head dictatorship, you know. But you heard about this. And many people, many scientists from academician circles thought maybe about this. In Georgia, Shevardnadze, dictatorship there, yes. And maybe after Shevardnadze, they have some people, some half a million or so. It's not interesting. Because you know, it's very difficult, in very difficult time, student of diplomatic academy, it's a good example that in one country, an independent country, is studying your article, your ideas of your colleagues. It is not so easy, because you know that the regime of Shevardnadze, it is not so. Shevardnadze know all about you, and you know who is he, and in the policy state we have, policy country we have. In this moment, in this time, the brave woman who is sitting here, Professor Sinsadze, his fight against this Polish country by your ideas. And I want to say that you must know, all of my friends must know, that it is this woman is brave woman. It's more brave than many, many men, I think so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vladimir Kilozonia from Georgia.
Mr. LaRouche,
speak up.
Invited guest and everybody who is here. My names are Godfrey Ayo from Uganda. I'm not the reincarnation of Godfrey Binaisa, but we share the same name, Christian name Godfrey. I live in Cologne. And as I've been listening to Mr. LaRouche, something has struck me about my continent. And that is unless Europe accepts to work together with Russia towards development, together with America, there is no hope for Africa. This sounds a very devastating concept for me to take back to myself. So in a way, are we going to wait on until this common focal point is struck, or do the sons and daughters of Africa have any right to do all that they can in their ability to try in their own way to find what could be best, better than what is already happening? We have seen cases in Africa whereby groups who have come up to try to establish their concept of democracy have been called terrible names. For example, Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. We have seen leaders like, for example, Milton Obote of Uganda, who has been the target of the British circles for the last 40 years, and lots of other leaders in Africa. What must we do? Do we rise up again and begin to ask for our independence? And if we shall rise up for a right cause, shall the sons of Africa be supported?
You have two categories of problems in Africa, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, and of course Sudan suffers from a combination of the problems which exist in northern Africa and also participates in the problems of southern sub-Saharan Africa. The problem is two. Number one, you have some powerful interests headed by the British monarchy and supported by American cabals, Anglo-American cabals, which the former president, George Bush, is an integral part. These people are running an operation in Africa, which is an intelligence operation which has been there ever since the colonial period. Africa was never given freedom. Sub-Saharan Africa was never given freedom. There were, for example, you look at South Africa, you would say the Republic of South Africa is a fairly powerful state. But you look inside it and you say no, because who controls the assets of South Africa? It is not the government of South Africa or the people. The assets are controlled by Anglo-American and other British, chiefly British-dominated interests. If you look at the situation in Zimbabwe, the question of the farmers, agreement was made, was never implemented. Intentionally so. The British never gave Africans freedom, nor did the French really. The colonial powers, during the course of the 1970s or somewhat before, said, we will now let the Africans run their own slave colony. So that African leaders were given the safety valve of saying, now you are the government of your country, but institutions based in London and Paris control the destiny of the nation behind the back leaders. And as time passed, and times came, 1963, 1971, the course of freedom in Africa was generally reversed. A crushing hand came down. The net growth of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, has been looting ever since, net looting. The policy in Africa today is genocide. The means of genocide, including creating private armies, recruiting children under 15 years of age to fight as soldiers to kill each other. The policy in Africa is to, in some cases, to allow some of the Africans to become educated, university graduates, and then work as shoeshine boys on the street. The intellectual elite, the young intellectual elite, is deprived of a role in running its own country. Private armies organized from outside, one against the other, gangs, conducting genocide, throughout the Great Lakes area and other areas. So you have the first thing is the Anglo-American empire, which consists of people in New York and Washington, the banking and lawyers crowd, the people behind George Bush, working together with the British in the usual way, with private interests, or that is really like the old British East India Company. The British Army never marched in its own uniform. It marched under private uniforms, as they did in India. And private armies controlled by the British monarchy, who are given implausible denial by the British monarchy itself. SIS, that's not SIS. MI5, that's disguised as not MI5, but really is, are running private armies with corporate interests, looting Africa, and organizing genocide as they have in the Great Lakes area. Now, that's the number one problem. And it has to be faced clearly. That's the number one problem. Africa does not control its own destiny. Private armies using often Africans to murder their brothers are creating a 30 years war genocidal condition throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And it's being done openly. Linda Chaka, for example. Lady Linda Chaka is directly running genocide on a map throughout sub-Saharan Africa. Every part of sub-Saharan Africa is marked to be chopped up into little entities and pieces. And Linda Chaka has the map of exactly those plans of the British government, of the British monarchy. You have American firms, often U.S. military, working in private armies under special warfare units under private contract, are working and running war under private armies in Africa. Prize raw mineral material areas are taken over by private interests and defended and possessed by private armies. We see what happened in West Africa in the genocide in that region. It's the number one problem. So don't say Africa is trying to make its own decisions and trying to find an African way. That is not occurring. There may some people in Africa dream of doing that. Some people are prepared to give their lives for the opportunity to do it, but it's not happening. There is mass murder being run from London with cooperation from Washington. Madeleine Halfbright, or Albright, or Miss Witch. Somebody said she can't fly. Well, she did fly. She was a witch. She's evil, evil woman. These people are, this is what the problem is. The second problem is that Africa has never been given the chance, sub-Saharan Africa has never been given the chance to actually escape from the conditions produced by Portuguese, Spanish, and other slavery, which unleashed from Europe under Venetian control, together with the Dutch, first the Portuguese, then the British, then the Dutch, unleashed a system of slavery in Africa at the beginning of the 16th century, which caused the greatest genocide in Africa, not merely from the slaves who were taken out of Africa, but by causing a panic reaction where the populations of Africa moved into the jungle and died to escape the slave catchers. Internal war. So Africa has not been given the opportunity to make its own decisions historically from that time to the present time. And there is no intention on the part of the holier-than-thou liberals in the United States or on the part of the British Empire, the Canadians, the United Kingdom, the Australians or the New Zealanders. There is absolutely no intention to allow the Africans to run their own country. The intent of the British, as stated by the former worst general commander in World War II, Field Marshal Montgomery, the man who probably prolonged the World War II at least 6 months, if not nine, by his incompetence. That's why he was put in power, like George Bush. He was incompetent. He prolonged the war by at least 6 months, maybe a year, by just his actions. This man was a racist, and he set forth the Rhodes Plan, and it's never changed. The plan of Europe, the plan of the British monarchy, is to reduce the human population of sub-Saharan Africa by so-called natural means, demographic warfare. And the Africans don't know it. Some do, but most don't. They think they're engaged in a struggle for freedom. The game is rigged. The game is rigged to prevent them from getting freedom. And when we realize that, and we say, oh, we talk about what Hitler did. Well, Hitler was small change compared to what the British have done in Africa. The British genocide in India was 7 organized famines as a population control device in India, and it's written about by the British East India Company's books, including James Mill and John Stuart Mill, who wrote about these plans. I was serving in that area at the time that a famine was going on, organized by the British against the Indian population during World War II inside India. When you face this fact, that's number one. The Africans have given no chance, and they are given no chance now. So it's not a matter of sitting back and listening to them and saying what they want to do. They're not going to get the chance. It's our job is to give them the chance, number one. That means we must have the power to give them the chance to deal with their own affairs. Number two, it's a looted country, a looted territory, without the resources necessary to sustain in a healthy condition, under present conditions, the existing population of Africa. Africa requires immediately an injection of assistance in several areas. For example, let's take the case of disease control. What is happening in Africa in terms of disease? This is already genocide. HIV is genocide now. Diseases which were sitting in pockets are breaking loose in Africa under these conditions, aggravated by this warfare, this regional warfare. They have no chance. We must deliver the means to enable them to take care of their own affairs. It is not a good idea to go in and become father and you say, you do this, you do this. You must give Africans the means adequate to do their own job. But there's certain things we know from the outset they require. These are not really debatable. The need for water management on a large scale, the need for transportation connections, it's always been the issue. The need for disease control, the need for power, the need to create the situation under which the African agricultural potential can be harvested without this great loss of the crop through various means. So these things must be given to Africa because it is Africa. And because we don't, we're not human. So it's not a matter of saying, let the Africans do it for themselves, or saying we're not confident about Africa, or we don't wish the best for the Africans, or we don't want the Africans to have the right to freedom. We do. But there's a powerful enemy called the Anglo-American oligarchy, centered around the British monarchy, and a powerful people of my own country who Bush typifies. And these people, as long as they have power, will not allow Africa under any circumstances to have the right to live. That's a fact. And that's why I say this Eurasia business. That's not a pessimistic statement about Africa. That's saying that we must have the power to free Africa from this blight. And if we don't have the power to force that, it's not going to happen. And if it doesn't happen, most of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, doesn't have a chance of anything but mass death. Genocide beyond belief. This is planned. This is intended. When the Prince Royal, or the British monarchy, says he wishes that if he would die, he would become a virus to kill off the excess population. And when you look at what he and what the World Wildlife Fund, or World Wild Fund for Nature, or the Wild Wildlife Fund, says, they mean it. They mean to reduce the total human population within a few decades to less than 1 billion people. and they mean virtually to eliminate most of the population of sub-Saharan Africa. That's their intention. If you allow them to have power, they will do it. The only choice is, are you going to allow them to continue to have that power? Because if you don't take that power away from them, it's going to happen. So let's have no illusions. Let's have no dreams of pride, false pride. This is murder. All of sub-Saharan Africa is in the process of being murdered deliberately by entities which have the power to do it and will do it unless we take that power away from them.
Just have a short question to Mr. Glazyev, because there were a few weeks ago a big commentary in the newspaper Die Welt by one of the American presidential candidate Pat Buchanan about that Americans should think about to draw Russia away from China, either that Russia and China together is too much. And is my question is Putin aware that in Russia and China lays the biggest economic potential of the future?
Well, I'll try to be brief because Professor Menchko already mentioned about these issues in Russian-American relations that under the Mr. Yeltsin presidency, his beloved foreign minister usually treats China as an enemy. But it was not taken seriously at that time, both by industrial managers and those who made foreign economic policy. And it is not the case now, of course. At the moment, we have a huge growth of cooperation with China. The Russian companies are actively participating in construction some new plants in high-tech industry in China, especially in aircrafts and in nuclear energy. We are thinking about the large-scale infrastructural projects in natural gas delivery to China and oil. A lot of Chinese working in Russia at the moment. In the Far East, we have a huge growth of economic activity coming from Chinese. And the trade is growing on. So it is quite obvious that the mutual opportunities for collaboration in the various branches of industry are quite good. And what is lacking of course, is the finance. Unfortunately, the Russia still continue trade in dollars. China is trading in dollars. And we need dollars to finance our bilateral trade, which, of course, creates additional bottlenecks and additional transaction costs. So what is necessary to develop further this cooperation is create good financial instruments. And so we should speak about maybe the trade in the national currencies, in using some kind of payments mechanisms in national currencies to overcome the barter trade or the trade in dollars. And also what is very important for the economic growth in the whole region of Eastern Asia is, of course, I think we should think about the some kind of international monetary organizations which will help to find credit facilities for large-scale international infrastructural projects which are discussed for a long period but unfortunately are not implemented as we want to do.
Mr. LaRouche,
My name is Chidi Kamalu. I'm from New York City, but I come from Nigeria originally. I'd like to ask you, how realistic is Hamiltonian credit in today's economic environment? Thank you.
Well, it's the only thing that'll work. The problem is, there's this myth of money. The idea of stateless money or stateless money issued by a state. This is a great illusion. Remember that the beginning of the system of this type, the American system in handling money, as opposed to what's being done now, started in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts under John Winthrop, beginning 1630, slightly after 1630 when this was introduced, that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which was not a colony of England at the time, it was given a charter by the British monarchy, but it was a separate entity accountable to the British monarchy for its charter, but it was independent of the British English government or a British government as such. So at that point, they issued their own currency in the form of paper scrip, which was not negotiable externally outside the colony, outside the Commonwealth, but was only to be used as a credit facility within the Commonwealth. The function of the scrip was guaranteed by the colony, and it was issued and used to employ people to produce things in the same way money is used, and to foster trade. As a result of this, which continued until about 1688, the rate of growth of the economy of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts was among the greatest in the world. Simply by this device, you had a very well-educated population. The characteristic of the Winthrop family, by the way, was they were the founders of serious education in the United States and were among the most important forces for education in Europe as a European civilization. These were not a bunch of dummies thrown on a boat and dumped on the shores of New England. This was a colony of very high quality, generally very well educated people. For example, if you go, just an example of the result of this, in the first census of the United States in that period, the average productivity and average income of the people of the United States was more than twice that of the population of the United Kingdom. The reason for that was the freedom of the people. You didn't have a real lucky class to speak of. And because of the system of education and development, which is what Hamilton reflected.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll continue in a moment with more of the May 4th discussion featuring Lyndon LaRouche and two Russian economists. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of the May 4th discussion featuring Lyndon LaRouche, Dr. Sergei Glazyev, who's the chairman of the Economics Commission of the Russian Duma, and Professor Stanislav Menshikov, all responding to questions from the audience at the Schiller Institute conference.
Hamilton also reflected directly, as did many of the colonists, reflected very strongly directly the influence of Gottfried Leibniz. For example, the Declaration of Independence, the language of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, was the result of the colonists taking the position early in the 18th century against John Locke, this phrase by Leibniz of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was in contradiction to Locke's doctrine of life, liberty, and property, which would be called slaveholder value or shareholder value. Same thing today. So that the influence of Leibniz in that period, through people like Jonathan Logan and through people in Boston, was direct. The influence on Hamilton of the concept of physical economy, as given by Leibniz, was direct to de Vattel, who was a German of some influence, and a Leibniz supporter in Germany, who traveled to the United States and was a very strong influence on the economic thinking of Hamilton. So the superiority of the American system of economy, which has always been superior to the British system from the beginning, except we had problems like Africa does today. We had some foreign oppressors who kept us from realizing some of the things we should have been able to do otherwise. And it wasn't until Lincoln's victory over the Confederacy that the United States emerged as what it had been potentially all along, as the leading nation technologically in the world. Yes, most of our science came from Europe, especially from Germany and France. But in terms of technology, in terms of our industries, our agriculture, we were the most advanced nation in the world at that time, which is why so many Europeans and Japanese and others copied us and took advice from us on how to do it. So the point, the system works. We don't need money as such. Money, there is no original hoard of money. If it is, we ought to burn it. Money is something which is, should be created only by the state. For example, the U.S. Constitution says the Federal Reserve System is illegal. It's unconstitutional. The issuance of currency of the United States can only be accomplished by an act of Congress, which allows that emission of U.S. currency note emission. So the basis of it is the creation of a system of credit, which includes the power of the state, the monopoly of the state over the creation of currency and the creation of credit. This is regulated in the public interest. It is regulated to promote things that are good, so the tax policy and credit policies must be designed to promote things that are good and to prevent things that are bad or to discourage them. So if you want to borrow for an illicit purpose, you'll pay the highest interest rate. You'll pay the highest tax. If you're a parasite and a speculator, your tax rate may be infinite. We may tax you for twice everything you earn, a speculation. But if you are an entrepreneur, investing in something, building a house, something useful, then your tax rate should be the lowest, and your interest rate should be the lowest, your borrowing costs, and your opportunity should be the greatest. So therefore, the responsibility of the nation is to do what de Gaulle called indicative planning. And the way to handle relations among states is the same way de Gaulle understood indicative planning. If you set targets, national targets, looking 25 years ahead, a generation ahead, you say, here's what the nation wishes to do. And the leadership of the nation then, once it agrees upon these targets, then goes to the consortium of the relevant private and public interests and says, here's what the nation requires. Here's the balance between infrastructure and the private sector. We wish somebody in the private sector would do this. We wish they would do that. We will help them if they will do it. And then you create a credit system which encourages this process. And the other thing you combine with it, otherwise the system doesn't work, as Nina said yesterday in our seminar yesterday, the key thing here is the education system. The first driver of an economy, the first determinant of the potential wealth of an economy, of the value of the currency, is the education system. If you educate people not to track them for the kind of jobs they're going to have, but to develop them as citizens, to steep them in the history of science and technology, so they live it, then you have a citizen, if he has no specialized training at the time he or she graduates from secondary school, is qualified for anything. Because it's a level of the secondary graduate that you've either built a human being or you haven't. If you've built them, then you can go on and they can have other skills and education beyond that, but the foundation has been laid. If you develop a population that thinks cognitively, that hates Kant, for example, that hates empiricism, hates Kant, despises this kind of thing, despises the Brandt reforms in Germany, that kind of population, that loves culture, that loves history, that loves science, has relived the experience of great scientific discoveries of the past. And every child in the nation has relived that kind of experience. Then you have a population in that time which can do anything. All you have to do is provide the more advanced education, the specialized training for it to undertake anything. The essence of a job is not to be skilled to do something. Because if that's the limit of your skill, you are going to become technologically obsolescent very soon, within 2 decades. You educate a population to bring it to a certain level. Then you design your national economic policies based on an employment policy which will utilize the quality of people you are producing by your educational system. And you will produce the population which is capable of meeting the tasks which your economic plan designs. That is money. Money is nothing but an instrument controlled by society and the state to enable the combination of private and public interests to cooperate to do this. The thing that makes it work, without which it does not work, is a classical humanist system of education up through the graduation from secondary school, and an advanced university system which is consistent with the principles of a secondary graduate trained in the classical humanist method. That's where the value of money comes from. The value of money comes from the ability of a human being to relive the great discoveries of principle of the past and to contribute to the making and implementation of new ones. That is the power to create wealth. How do we invest? Why do we mean by investing? We mean by employing people to create wealth. How do you create wealth? You create wealth by making fundamental scientific discoveries which transform man's power in nature. By using fundamental discoveries of principle to derive technologies which enable you to improve things. To exchange ideas about these things and to cooperate with people in using these new discoveries and technologies. That is the source of wealth. The source of wealth is the human mind, not the human back. If you want the back, get yourself a donkey, not a child.
My name is Jean Gahururu. I'm coming from Rwanda, and I'd like to address my question to Dr. Grassier. With best excuse that I missed the occasion of yesterday, I should have address this question directly, but I had a crucial issue that impeached me to come. But anyway, the question has a general aspect, and it concerns the compatriots of us who have been trained in Russia, now being in Africa, at this time of so-called liberalization, and in the condition of, in the situation of collapse of the East Bloc, these people have a very great problem in Africa, here to being destroyed as human beings because identified to the former communist regime and as such really persecuted as communists, as people who have no value, despite their academician degrees and their training, which enable them to be active in the economy of our countries. We have a problem of such people everywhere in Africa. Since the East Bloc have collapsed, a situation which could be described as an intellectual genocide of the Russian-trained scientists and academicians. This is a very big problem, you know. For instance, as you know, that many of our Africans who have been trained in Russian, maybe they was social competent that they get married there, and they come at home with Russian race, the problem became as such dramatic when also those persons are persecuted with your beloved compatriots in Africa. So my question is, does have Russian a possibility to make a bridge, as as it was at the Soviet Union time to Africa, intellectually, academically, technologically, and scientifically. Thank you. Is this question raised somewhere in the circles, the power circles of Russia? If this question happened to be discussed, a bridge across the borders from Russia to Africa. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure that answer is yes, but there are those problems which arise, unfortunately, are not well known in Russia. Of course, there are still a lot of opportunities for cooperation and involving these people in some kind of mutual economic and intellectual activity. I should say that perhaps the key problem for those people which are educated in the Soviet Union in the former time is perhaps not really that they were educated as the communists, but mainly because they are educated in a way of promotion, mutually beneficial multinational economic cooperation. You know that the cooperation between the Soviet Union and Africa was not based on financial or other kind of exploitation of African countries from the Soviet Union. It was basically the cooperation which includes first the technological transfer to Africa, the second construction of large industrial plants in Africa, education of people, and of course military delivery of military stuff which was necessary in struggle for independence. Almost all of those credits were unprofitable in terms of commercial interest of the Soviet Union. For instance, at the moment, the debt of African countries to the Soviet Union costs nothing. When Russia joined the Paris Club, the rescheduling of the African, especially South Africa, South part of Africa countries' debt to Russia includes the 90% discount with payments of other 10% in 23 years. It means that, in fact, that all those investments which Soviet Union did in Africa didn't give back the profits in terms of money. But, of course, they give back a lot of other kind of profits in terms of markets, in terms of cooperation, in terms of promotion of economic growth. And in a lot of cases, instead of paying this marginal part of debt, it will be better to use this debt for further cooperation. But you see, those way of multilateral and bilateral cooperation between Soviet Union and African countries was not recognized by the financial oligarchy standards. And this kind of cooperation undermines the whole way of thinking. And for this reason, these people who are, I'm sure, have a good education and good opportunities are persecuted not as a communist, but as a careers of this another way of thinking how the mutual economic cooperation could be organized. I should say that this case which you described concerning the African countries is you see, it's only African case, I should say. The problem is that we do not face such problems in India, for instance, or in China, where also we have a lot of people educated in the Soviet Union. We do not have such problems even in the most of Arab countries, where we also have a lot of engineers, politicians, military officers educated in the Soviet Union. So this is the particular case of African countries, which I think supports those arguments which Mr. LaRouche stressed, speaking about how oligarchy suppress and undermine the African opportunities for independent development.
Hi, my name is Erin Regan from Los Angeles. And basically, since we're facing a global economic collapse, which is the problem, and the solution seems to be the New Silk Road or the Eurasian Land Bridge for economic development, most people in America have blinders to the rest of the world. And they kind of think of themselves as their own planet that rotates around the rest of the world and that they're not connected to anything. And I'm sure that some people in other countries think that their country is the most important for development. So I was wondering, how do we defeat the problem, the ideology of acting locally and only thinking globally? Which seems to be a big problem.
Well, two things. First of all, the problem with most Americans today, most Americans I know, as opposed to the Americans I knew when I was a young man, particularly before the death of Roosevelt, is that the American today thinks like human cattle. They think like slaves. They're not actually enslaved, except that they put the shackles on their arms every morning before they go to work and take them off only when they go to sleep at night or whatever else they is they do at night. Therefore, if you think of yourself as an animal, then, and people who think of themselves as human cattle think of themselves actually as like animals. You look, for example, at the typical American entertainment. Look at television. Look at the newspapers. Look at the movies. Look at the books. Go into a bookstore and see what the titles are and what the subject areas are that are sold in a bookstore. Then get a picture, if you can, of the same bookstore 20 years ago or 10 years ago. And get a picture of what's sold on the shelves of the bookstore 10 years ago or 20 years ago. What you find on the bookstore shelves today are mostly horoscopes, strange varieties of sex, the discovery of the fifth or 25th sex, and so forth, and real kook stuff. I mean, real ugly kook stuff. And this is what the American book reader buys and reads. You look at what... For example, television and movie entertainment no longer has a story. It's a cascade of violence and sex and strange things, witchcraft, the subnatural, sometimes called the supernatural, but it's actually the subnatural. So you look at that. You say, how are these people thinking? You bring up the question, as in a university, of an idea. Don't forget, I don't go there. I don't like the question. I don't go there. So you get, what you get is a withdrawal from the cognitive aspects of life, a withdrawal of facing the questions where you are looking at society and saying, what should the decision be about this problem? You know, just somebody reading a book, former times, read a book, read a number of books, think about the problem that the book is dealing with. Think about what that means. Read about history. Try to understand things, which means that you're thinking like a citizen, like a human being, because you're thinking as if you were responsible for society. What would I do in this situation, for example, is the typical question of any average intelligent person who's a free-thinking citizen. What would I have done in this situation? What would I do in this situation? These are the kind of people who will tend to vote intelligently, to discuss intelligently. But the typical American does not. The typical American leads the most boring life at all. You think of a slave on a slave plantation. And the level, the cultural level, and the sense of identity is probably inferior to what any slaves who lived on slave plantations was. As you see from the Negro spiritual, they probably had more sense of humanity than the typical, technically unshackled American of today. Because they're shackled by their nothingness. And to escape from their nothingness and boredom, they desire titillation, excitement, sensual thrills, kicks. What's important to them is now, the so-called now generation. We now have the post-now generation, the yesterday generation. The immediate gratification. So the American is told, the important thing is the society is to give you the opportunity for gratification, either upon or against your next-door neighbor. In the next instant. You may change your opinion the next day, but the next instant, that's it. So the problem is you have an alienation. Now, the point is to set the stage for the point, the answer. The answer is if you lift the individual, get them above the level of this bestiality, which is what most Americans live in today, an induced bestiality, which has become acute increasingly over the past 35 years, before you were born. They began degenerating. You may have observed that, and you may have come to that conclusion a few times yourself. They degenerated. A process of cultural and moral generation of the American population, which all goes with this withdrawal into this pleasure society, which is not really pleasure. It's sort of, I must get in sensual titillation, stronger, like a stronger drug than I had yesterday, in order to get my head through the next few hours. And that's what American entertainment is. That's what American culture is. So if the only way you can do to correct that is you have to uplift the American by the sense of when they turn off the electricity, the television set goes out too. That they will have to figure out. Huh? What happens when the television set goes off? Now the shock of reality says that the pleasure society is gone and they go either go crazy or they go up. Now our job is to, as we're doing with the D.C. General Hospital, the fight about the issue of energy and so forth, our job is to awaken these people to issues which they can understand, which are real, on which they can get a sense of judgment and justice. When they see that they are have-nots and have nothing and are about to get less than nothing, they suddenly say, what is important? You say, well, what about your health care? Yes, they say, that is important. Well, it's being taken away from you when D.C. General Hospital is going to happen all over the country. You won't get any health care. Is that important? Yes. You think you should fight for it? Yes. You think everybody should have it? Yes. What about energy? You think you should have electricity at prices you can afford and right, reliable? Yes. Okay. Once they make the decision that they have to act in their own interest and strike the shackles off their hands and act like free people, then they change the way they behave. When you change the way you behave and you think about principles like general welfare, then suddenly you lift up your eyes and you look beyond the borders of the United States and you see a world out there. Now, this is not too difficult for Americans if they want to, because the United States is a semi-melting pot nation. Most people came from Europe. Except in part, some parts they came from Mexico, which is partly Europe, and some from China, Japan, and so forth, and Korea, as in California. So the United States is also a reflection of the population of the world. People have in second, third, first generation connections to other countries through immigration. You can go into California, Southern California, Korea, or San Francisco, Koreans, Chinese, so forth, they're all there. Some first and second generation. So the outreach to other parts of the world is immediate for us when, as an American with a friend who's Korean origin or whatnot, an American can instantly think about common interests in terms of the countries from which many Americans came or their friends came. So the point is not that the United States is insular in its mentality. It's not. The point is the American was not insular during World War II. overseas, for example, in India, I can tell you that in India and Burma, when I was in service there, that most American soldiers believe that India should have independent, immediate independence and should have U.S. assistance in the economic development to realize that independence. We realized by seeing the poverty of the Indians, say, as I did in Bengal, in the poor bullies in Bengal, and seeing what they lived on, how little they lived on, what little they had. Our sense was this was unjust. They should have their rights. And if Roosevelt had not died, they would have had those rights right away. Roosevelt did die. My fellow Americans degenerated under Truman and what that brought, and we lost it. But it's still in the American culture. It's embedded in many ways in the culture if you revive it. And all we have to do is take issues like the D.C. General, the energy crisis, and other things of that nature, and get Americans to start to move again in their own interests, to shed, first of all, this I need my pleasure now kind of thing, and begin to think about their lives, their future, their family. And they will automatically think about principles. They will think about other countries. And they will react as people in my time during the last war did. When you saw people abroad, we thought there was injustice. We thought it was wrong. We said we cannot go home from this war and leave the world in this mess and not think we're going to have another war in the future with this kind of injustice.
You've been listening to EIR Talks featuring Lyndon LaRouche and others in a discussion on May 4th in Bad Schwalbach, Germany. To read the full transcript of the conference or to replay this program, visit our website at larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.